those subjects, and in the future, your knowledge and vision may further expand.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and that is the universal aspect of his personality. George Ardaq has very appropriately given the title to his book, where he says, Al-Imam Ali, Sawt al-Adalat al-Insaniya. That Ali is the voice of human justice. Because when you look at the sense of justice of Amir al-Mu'mineen, it is even that sense of justice. Then his mind and his heart is universal. Applies to everything, even animals. One example again in that same context of the government and how he used to deal with the people. A person by the name of Ash'as bin Qais, a munafiq. The reason I'm saying munafiq because he was, you know, a hypocrite, didn't like Ali. His daughter is the one who poisoned Imam Hassan. And his son, Muhammad bin Ash'as, was the one of the officers of Yazidi forces in Karbala. So the whole family is a family of nifaq in a way. And he came one day to the house of Ali. Apparently it was night time, with a flask of honey, a container of honey. Honey is sweet. But when Amir al-Mu'mineen looked at it, to Ali, it was not sweet, it was poison. Not because poison had been put in it. This person had actually come to bribe Ali. There was an issue he wanted to be done, and Ali had not yet given the response positively. And so Amir al-Mu'mineen asked him, what is this? Asilatun am zakatun am sadaqa? Why did you bring this for me, this honey? Is this a reward of something that I have done? I have not done anything for you. Or is this part of zakat or sadaqa? And if it is that, فَذَلِكَ مُحَرَّمٌ عَلَيْنَا أَهْلُ الْبَيْتِ. If it is zakat and sadaqah, then it's haram for us on Ahlul Bayt. We can't use it. He says, no, it's not this, not that. This is hadiyah. And Amir al-Mu'mineen knew this is not a hadiyah. He's trying to bribe Amir al-Mu'mineen. And that is where Amir al-Mu'mineen says something which is really worth pondering on those words. Where he says, وَاللَّهِ لَوْ أُعْطِيتُ الْأَقَامْ لِيمَ السَّبْعَ بِمَا تَحْتَ أَفْلَاكِهَا ألا أن أعصي الله في نملة أسلبها جلب شعيرة ما فعلته. He says, by Allah, if I am given the kingdom of the seven heavens and whatever is beneath it, with one condition that I should disobey the command of Allah regarding a small ant and pull away the grain of barley from its mouth, by Allah, I will never do it. Just think about it. Somebody is given the choice. You become the master of the seven heavens and whatever is underneath it. And you have to all do one thing. There is one ant which is a grain of barley in its mouth. Just pull it out. What do you think about it? Look at the equation there. Al-aqalim as-sab'a, seven heavens and whatever is beneath it. And one, grain of barley. And this is where Amir al-Mu'mineen is showing that, we have to remember. The goal does not justify the means. Many times we get confused there. Maybe there was a very shrewd politician. He will say, okay, I'll pull out that grain of barley. And once I become the king of the kingdoms, of the heavens and the earth, I'll give 10 barley to this same ant. But Amir al-Mu'mineen is saying, I don't want my government to be based on committing a sin, an injustice, even to a creature like a small ant.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
believe that he does have ties to Muslim extremists. I don't know.
On September 8, 2022, Queen Elizabeth II died at the age of 96. As her death prompted an outpouring of grief from her admirers, it also revived criticism of her legacy, bringing into relief the complex feelings of those who consider her as a symbol of the British colonial empire, an institution that enshrined itself through violence, theft, and oppression. Elizabeth II died less than a year after Barbados removed her as its head of state and became a republic, a move that partly stemmed from growing criticism of the British monarchy among Caribbean countries.
Presiding within the under English colonial rule, it becomes the laboratory for plantation societies in the Caribbean. It is in Barbados that English law, for the first time, knows a distinction in the racial status of subjects of the crown, in the sense that laws are passed which say essentially that people who are Negroes, and that word is borrowed from the Spanish, are fit for particular kinds of punitionary laws, as the text runs. So it is, Barbados does become the laboratory for a slave society, which is then exported to Jamaica in the 1650s and 60s, and to the Carolinas and then Georgia after that.
Others, including Jamaica, have hinted at declaring their independence too.
60 years of independence. We have not forgotten, and we demand an apology and reparation.
Our goal is to loosen and remove the hands, the gloved hands of the Queen from around our necks so that we can breathe.
Earlier in August, Senator Lydia Thorpe of Australia called Queen Elizabeth a colonizer during her swearing-in ceremony.
To the colonizing Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II.
Senator Thorpe. The start of Queen Elizabeth's reign in 1952 coincided with her government ordering the suppression of the Mau Mau independence uprising in Kenya.
We made the point repeatedly that it looked extremely immoral for Her Majesty's government, which is not contesting and has in fact admitted that atrocities were committed, torture was committed, that they have admitted. Now, for them to continue relying on technicalities, being well aware that the majority of these victims are in the 80s, late 80s, that many of them live in squalid poverty, that many of them are not even able to afford health care in their old age, what could be more despicable? What could be more immoral than Her Majesty's government to continue as it were, to buy time, simply to wait for all these veterans to die one by one before tasting justice?
Much of the protesters were put in concentration camps and used as slave labor if they weren't murdered by British soldiers. Almost 1 year after the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II, she oversaw one of the nastiest coup d'etats in modern history. Planned by Britain's MI6 and then executed by America's CIA, the coup overthrew Iran's democratically elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh, paving the way for the tyrannical regime of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi that lasted for almost three decades and sowing distrust of the British among the Iranian nation. Elizabeth's reign was marked by rocky periods of irregular violence abroad, including Britain's ill-fated attempt to gain control of the Suez Canal in 1956 and the Falklands War, a 10-week-long battle with Argentina in 1982, in which the British responded to Buenos Aires' reclamation of territory with flames of war. Closer to home, the British Army waged its longest military campaign to date, Operation Banner, an effort to establish order during the Troubles, a bloody sectarian conflict that engulfed much of Northern Ireland between 1968 and 1998. British troops were given a green light to massacre 14 civilians in Northern Ireland on a protest march against Britain's policy of jailing Catholics without trial. The British establishment oversaw cover-up inquiries into what became known as Bloody Sunday. In the twilight years of the Queen's rule, her government invaded Iraq on the pretext of destroying non-existent weapons of mass destruction. During the long years of a joint British and U.S. occupation, it is likely that more than a million Iraqis died and millions more were driven from their homes. Over centuries, the U.K. has funneled trillions of dollars from its colonies to enrich itself. The monarchy was built on slavery, establishing a slave trade that saw the transport of millions of Africans and South and North Americans to other countries. The slave trade was so vast, in fact, that it wasn't until 2015 that the country fully paid off its debts to slave owners from freeing slaves in the 19th century. Although Queen Elizabeth II did not herself enact these policies, her reign was a continuation of the earlier ones. Some historians believe she bears responsibility for all these atrocities. In the words of Harvard University history professor Maya Jasanoff, by design as much as by the accident of her long age, her presence as head of state and head of the Commonwealth, an association of Britain and its former colonies, put a stolid traditionalist front over decades of violent upheaval. As such, the Queen helped obscure a bloody history of decolonization whose proportions and legacies have yet to be adequately acknowledged. All in all, as Commander-in-Chief of the British Armed Forces, Queen Elizabeth oversaw a great number of wars and conflicts, including the Mau Mau Uprising in Kenya, the Jebel Akhdar War in Oman, the Cyprus Emergency, the Suez Crisis in Egypt, the Border Campaign in Ireland, the First Cod War in Iceland, the Upper Jaffa Disturbance in Yemen, the Dhofar Rebellion in Oman, the Indonesia-Malaysia confrontation in Borneo, the Aden emergency in Yemen, the Troubles in Northern Ireland, the Second Cod War in Iceland, the Third Cod War in Iceland, the Falklands War in Argentina, the multinational force in Lebanon, the Persian Gulf War in Iraq, the Bosnian War, Operation Desert Fox in Iraq, the Kosovo War, the Sierra Leone Civil War, the War in Afghanistan, the Iraq War, the First Libyan Civil War, Operation Shader in Iraq and Syria. Taraka Love, senior newsletter writer for New York Magazine, wrote, "For 96 years, that colonizer has been sucking up the Earth's resources, You can't be a literal oppressor and not expect the people you have oppressed not to rejoice on news of your death. Last but not least, the royal family's deep-seated racism appeared to persist even to the last days of the Queen. In 2020, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, left the royal family over racism within the family. Like all monarchs, Elizabeth was both an individual and an institution. As for her individual life, there is little information beyond her love of horses and dogs or a dysfunctional family. As an institution, not much to take pride in. A disappeared empire and a list of wars that claimed many innocent lives.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats in chanty whisper. I say, why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. And we would like to actually express our condolences and sorrow and sadness for the martyrdom of, the master of the martyrs, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, peace be upon him. We're going to talk about some of the Islamic laws regarding the mourning ceremonies of Imam Hussein, or in commemoration of his martyrdom, and also Arba'in. Well, before that, let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Khamenei, and we'll be back. Don't go away.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Majad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Sheikh Javid, let's talk about prostration or sajda. You know, some people, I've seen the pilgrims, when they go to, for example, graves of the great infallibles, like Imam Hussein, for example, and they start prostrating when they see the shrine or when they enter the courtyard of the shrine or the graveyard, prostrate. Would you please talk about this? Is this permissible in terms of Sharia law according to Ayatollah Khomeini's fatwas?
A'udhu billahi min shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Well, we all know very well that sajda is exclusively for God, and no one deserves to be, deserves prostration in the sense that we, that God deserves, okay? So, according to all religious authorities, including His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, it's not permissible to prostrate oneself in front of the graves of the infallibles, including the shrine or the tomb of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. And of course, those people who go to such places and do sajda, they have no knowledge of the Islamic laws. They have no knowledge or little knowledge about this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important to inform them, to let them know that such a practice is not permissible according to the religious authorities. And of course, the religious authorities get their verdicts and their rulings from the Quran and the prophetic tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And they do not give a fatwa unless they are certain about it.
Yes.
So we should know that it's not permissible to prostrate ourselves.
When they do it, of course, I know you and I, even our audience,
yeah,
would know. They do it out of their courtesy. They don't prostrate to worship.
To worship. And of course, they don't mean to worship.
Yes.
They do it out of respect.
Exactly.
But you should know that, of course, this is exclusively for God.
For God,
For Allah alone. And we cannot prostrate for anyone else,
uh-huh,
even though we mean respect or we mean a veneration,
yeah,
or something.
Yes, that's correct. Thank you very much. Shasta, would you talk about, those places where our prayers are shortened? You know, in some places I've heard that the prayers need to be shortened, right? You can, or where you cannot shorten your prayer, or you have the choice of
You're
not
right.
doing so.
You know, there are four places, according to Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, where we are free to choose between complete prayers and shortened prayers.
Mm-hmm.
Like Masjid al-Haram is the first important and the most important place where we can choose to offer full prayers or shortened prayers. Although you're a traveler.
Yes.
A traveler, of course, as someone who is not a traveler, as someone who is a resident of the holy city of Mecca,
mm-hmm,
he cannot shorten his prayers.
Yes.
And then it is also permissible for a pilgrim to, for a traveler, to shorten his prayer in Masjid al-Nabi or in the entire city of Medina. Mm-hmm. In Medina,
yes,
you are allowed to shorten your prayers or offer full prayers as a traveler.
In the entire city or only the...
In the city, in the entire
prophetic
city.
Prophetic mosque.
Yes, in the city.
Okay.
Now, when it comes to the third place where you are allowed to choose between shortened and full prayers is Masjid al-Kufa, okay? Of course, there is some controversy about the city of Kufa because Ayatollah Sistani says that, okay, it is permissible to offer full prayers in the entire the city, okay, the city of Kufa.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the case with Ayatollah Khamenei, as he says that a traveler can choose to offer shortened prayer or full prayers only in the
vicinity.
In the vicinity of the mosque or in the mosque premises,
uh-huh,
and not out of the mosque, not in any other place. Like for example,
so
there
within
are many,
the walls of the mosque.
Yeah, there are many places, very important places in the holy city of Kufa. Like for example, Masjid Salah, which is also a well-known mosque.
Mm-hmm.
In Kufa,
yes.
According to His Eminence Ayatollah Khamenei, it's not permissible to offer full prayers in that mosque.
Mm-hmm.
As a traveler.
Yes. What about the fourth one?
And the fourth one, of course, is is offering prayers in the holy shrine of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. According to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, it is permissible to shorten our prayers or to offer full prayers within the walls of the tomb or the place where the tomb is on the chamber, and then there are walls around the chamber, and of course one as a pilgrim is allowed to offer full prayers within that structure, within that building, and not in the courtyard, which is of course around the building, because there's a building inside the
mm-hmm.
inside the shrine, and there are walls around the courtyard. The courtyard and the walls around the courtyard are not included. So as a pilgrim, one should shorten. If you are willing to offer your prayers in the holy shrine, you cannot shorten, you cannot offer full prayers in the courtyard of the holy shrine, but rather inside the building, which is close to the chamber.
Okay, thank you very much for your nice answer. Let's take a short break and we'll be back to our program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
Stars, your eyes pull me to you, who are you? I walk in the day with millions of angels. I see you in all these faces, who are you? One step I fade away, the next step I'm born again. You're flowing. To me, desire, drink some water. Desire.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Marjad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, still in the program. We are talking about, some of the rules regarding the commemoration of, Imam al-Hussein's martyrdom anniversary and Arba'in around this time and this special occasion Sheikh Javid, let me ask you this question, because this is also a very frequently reported question, and that's about the ghusl. You know, a lot of people, a lot of pilgrims, in fact, they sort of resort to a kind of ablution for visitation.
Sure.
So they perform ablution and ghusl for their visitation or before they do it, you know, and they perform this ghusl. And let me ask you this, if this, you know, ghusl or ablution is, first of all, which we call it, recommended or not, and then if so, then can it count as a kind of wudu too or not?
Well, ghusl, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, is recommended. And it does not make any difference. And it does not differ from any other recommended ghusl.
Right.
So as per his fatwa, of course, recommended ghusl is not sufficient for wudu. And it's necessary for a pilgrim or for whatever, for any individual who
yes.
who performs a recommended ghusl to make wudu. So wudu is required.
Right.
But of course there are some scholars and some religious authorities who is of the view that recommended ghusl is sufficient for wudu. But he is of the view that ghusl ziyara or ghusl which is performed before the visitation of a shrine is not has not been proved to be recommended. And so he doubts or he suspects that it is recommended because in his view, such a ghusl does not seem to be recommended. Mm-hmm. It has not been proved to him because there is little evidence to indicate that such a ghusl is actually recommended.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, as per his fatwa, it is necessary to make wudu also because otherwise, according to his opinion, every mustahab ghusl that is proven to be recommended is sufficient for wudu.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice answers and enlightening us with the answers from the religious authority, from Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas and religious laws or Islamic laws regarding such a special days. So thank you very much, my dear listeners and audience, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We bid you farewell, and please keep us in your du'as and prayers. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new lands.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
In the years following the 11th of September 2001, anti-Muslim sentiments has grown in the United States. Studies showed from 2001 to 2009, hate crimes against Muslims in the United States increased by 500%. According to experts, former U.S. President Donald Trump's approach against Muslims is an example of an unprecedented anti-Islamic government in America. But what is currently worrying is that manifestation of Islamophobia has not decreased in the administration of current President Joe Biden. We will now take a look at the world media's coverage of this subject. Please stay with us. Al Jazeera's website writes, "The Muslim population of the United States has increasingly been the target of Islamophobia and hate crimes in the years following the suspicious 9/11 attacks, which unleashed a new era of racism and discrimination against Muslims. On the 21st anniversary of the attacks on Sunday, 11th of September, the executive director of the Los Angeles chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE, Hossam Ailouche, said that Muslims continue to face the threat of targeted violence. Hossam Ailouche added, "Muslims continue to be the target of hate, bullying and discrimination as a result of the stereotypes that were perpetuated by Islamophobes and the media in the years following the 9/11 attacks." According to FBI statistics, hate crimes against Muslims skyrocketed immediately after the 9/11 attacks in 2001 and are still on an upward trend. Hossam Ailouche said, "The unfortunate reality is there are people and organizations that benefit from perpetuating Islamophobia, bigotry and war." Ailouche further said that the statistics were not surprising considering the current volatile political climate in the United States, perpetuated by former President Donald Trump during his term in office, adding, "Trump's presidency normalized being an anti-Muslim bigot. He made it socially acceptable to be overtly anti-Muslim." Upon taking office in January of 2017, Donald Trump signed an executive order that banned travel to the United States from 7 predominantly Muslim countries. Citing the Muslim ban, Ailouche said, "Although the current administration overturned that ban, we're still dealing with the ramifications of it to this day, with many families still being separated." Hossam Ailouche noted that the U.S. has a long history of dehumanizing and marginalizing ethnic and religious groups, including Native Americans, African Americans, and Asian Americans. The Hill, an American newspaper based in Washington, D.C., explains more about this story. Since the 11th of September 2001 attacks, Muslims living in the United States have experienced political and cultural firsts, along with an exponential rise in hate crimes, bullying, harassment, and racial profiling. In the years following the 9/11 attacks, anti-Muslim sentiments grew in the United States. Data from Brown University revealed from 2000 to 2009, hate crimes against Muslims spiked 500%. Beyond former President Barack Obama's presidency, critics contend that former President Donald Trump's policies exhibited animosity towards the community, such as his Muslim travel ban, which included predominantly Muslim countries. In 2020, the Justice Department found there were 110 anti-Muslim incidents in the United States. The Department of Justice also found that religion was the second most common reason for single bias incidents in the United States. A Pew Research survey found U.S. Republicans increasingly associated Muslims with Islam and violence, with 72% of Republicans in 2021 believing Islam was more likely than other religions to encourage violence. Among Democrats, 32% felt the same. Abdullah Hamoud, the first Muslim American mayor of Dearborn, Michigan, told Changing America that there was a sense of urgency among members of the Muslim American community to step up and push back against Islamophobia in a post-9/11 America. Before becoming mayor of Dearborn, Hamoud ran for a seat in Michigan's state legislature. He shared that doors were slammed in his face when he introduced himself. Representatives Rashida Tlaib, a Democrat from Michigan, and Ilhan Omar, a Democrat from Minnesota, became the first Muslim women to be elected to Congress. The Progressive Squad members are two of the most prominent Muslim voices in American politics, elected in the Blue Wave 2018 midterm elections during the Trump administration. Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar have previously shared that they've received violent threats during their time in U.S. Congress. The Middle East Monitor has more on the same story. Commemorations for the 9/11-2001 events remain an important part of U.S. history, but for Muslim Americans, post-9/11 ramifications of Islamophobia have bled deep into the fabric of American society more than two decades later. As a result, 21 years after the suspicious attacks, Muslims continue to face the threat of targeted violence and are working to amplify narratives about Muslims that are authentic and accurate to counter the spread of misinformation. According to FBI statistics, hate crimes immediately against Muslims skyrocketed after the 9/11 attacks, rising 1.61% from 2000 to 2001, marking some of the highest hate numbers of Islamophobic hate crimes ever seen in America. Referring to an August 2022 study, Zahra Jamal, Associate Director of Rice University's Boniuk Institute for Religious Tolerance in Houston, Texas, said 62% of Muslims report feeling religion-based hostility from others, and 65% have felt disrespected. That's almost three times the percentage among Christians. She said Muslims in the United States also reported that they have been threatened with physical violence, chased or followed, or had their home vandalized due to their religion. They also have higher rates of experiencing physical assault or property damage due to their religion. According to Zahra Jamal, just over 80% of Muslims reported that others assumed things about them due to their religion, while 21% of Muslim adults reported police harassment. She said the numbers related to discrimination against Muslims are alarming and show just how much Islamophobia has increased in the United States over the past several years. Zahra Jamal added, "For Muslims, scores on the Islamophobia Index have increased from 18 in 2018 to 26 in 2022.
Politicians like Bernie Sanders and Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez have heaped praise on Sweden as the political system of their dreams. Yet this Swedish model is uglier than it might appear to be. As Swedish stand-up comedian Magnus Bettner once said, we're a nation of beautiful people singing happy songs in stylish modernist apartments. But that's not how we Swedes see ourselves. We have a very, very dark side, and I think you're only just finding out about it now. For more than a century, Swedes from Alfred Nobel to teen climate activist Greta Thunberg have been lecturing the world on peace, justice and progress while turning a blind eye to the more disturbing elements of their own history. Swedes suppress the memory of their nation's long-standing slave trade as one of the pillars of their economy. The country was also a major supplier of iron chains used in the slave trade. The Swedes traded slaves up to the mid-19th century. During most of World War II, the Swedes had a willing collaboration with Nazi Germany, even while technically maintaining neutrality. In the words of Elisabeth Asbrink, Sweden managed to maneuver itself through the war without officially taking sides, so all the people in Sweden who wanted Hitler to win, and there were many of them, never had to deal with the consequences of the stigma that collaborators in the occupied countries received. They also don't discuss the 63,000 of their fellow citizens who were forcibly sterilized right up until 1976 to keep the welfare system free of children who might inherit mental or physical disabilities. In fact, Sweden has never been an ideal place for women. The country's rape statistics are among the highest in Europe. In Sweden, almost every second, a woman reports lifetime exposure to some kind of serious violence, of which 65% is sexual harassment and 20% is sexual violence.
As a woman, you know that these things happen, but that what was overwhelming was that it was so common, and especially the testimonies from the cultural sector, from artists, from actresses. I feel quite encouraged and empowered by all these testimonies from different sectors of the Swedish society, that the tolerance on sexual harassment is really over now.
Rape survivors in Sweden continue to face barriers in accessing justice, and few investigations have led to prosecution and conviction. Moreover, Sweden is a destination country for women trafficked from countries such as Romania, Russia, and Nigeria for the purpose of commercial sexual exploitation. Meanwhile, around 25,500 cases of abuse against children below 18 years of age were reported to the Swedish authorities in 2020. A 2006 report released by Global Monetary on the commercial sexual exploitation of children found systemic faults in Sweden, including allowing child pornography to be viewed and failing to care properly for children caught up in sex trafficking.
The sexual exploitation of vulnerable people, vulnerable children, is never acceptable. But when it is perpetrated by people in positions of power, people we entrust to help and protect, it rightly sickens and disgusts, and it should compel us to take action.
A steep increase in immigration since 2011 has tested the limits of Swedish generosity. Back in November 2021, Stockholm abandoned its heroic rhetoric of welcoming refugees just to adopt the harsh language only far-right nativists of the Sweden Democrats Party used in 2015. Sweden now forcibly returns asylum seekers despite the worsening security situation in the country of origin.
Really, I don't know, because yesterday I seen the TV and the internet. This is, I think this is not really, because this is writing this 80,000 people this go back to the country. But which people, which country, I don't know. And I think this is only speak.
On the other hand, racism is blighting Swedish society, and people of African descent face daily harassment and hate crimes. The anti-immigration, anti-Islam Sweden Democrats is now the largest party in southern Sweden and the third largest party in the Swedish parliament. According to the UN Working Group of Experts of People of African Descent, a real fear within the communities, especially for young black men, is that they could be violently attacked at any time. As a result of structural racism, black people in Sweden have reduced access to healthcare and education, while the police view them as criminals rather than a vulnerable community that needs protection. While Sweden is no longer open to the desperate people coming from war-stricken countries, it is still a safe haven for the Mujahedin Khalq organization, the MKO, a terrorist group which has assassinated tens of thousands of Iranian citizens since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Meanwhile, over the last 20 years, Sweden has gone from having one of the lowest to one of the highest levels of gun violence in Europe, worse than Italy or Eastern Europe. The increase in gun homicide in Sweden is closely linked to criminal melee in socially disadvantaged areas. Swedish Minister of Finance, Magdalena Andersson, boasted last year that her Swedish Social Democratic Party added 7,000 new police officers, built more prisons, and drafted laws creating 30 new crimes. In the land of generous welfare, the Roma people, primarily citizens of Romania and Bulgaria, continue to face discriminatory treatment, with many sleeping in tents or temporary settlements on the outskirts of the cities. Surprisingly enough, Stockholm has failed to recognize its own indigenous Sami people's rights.
The Swedish government needs to stop the colonization of Sápmi. We believe that the climate, the environment, clean air, water, reindeer herding, indigenous rights and the future of humanity should be prioritized before and above the short-term profit of a company, a British mining company.
The major preacher of human rights has been selling arms to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates since 1998, with most of the sales over the past decade. That's while the two Arab countries have been involved since 2015 in a bloody war against Yemen. There is no sign of a slowdown in this arms sales relationship. Sweden's arms manufacturer Saab opened an office in Abu Dhabi in 2017. The question is, how can Sweden be a peace broker if it's also selling the arms that make the war in Yemen possible? By and large, Sweden is using its undeserved benevolent reputation as a mask for serious violations of human rights on its soil.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.